And if you're at all confused about Revelation, start at the back and keep going backwards. You'll be there. All right. Chapter 13, first 10 verses. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but he had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?" The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast. All whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. This is the word of the Lord.
Just before we begin, if you're sort of wondering who it is that I'm encouraging you to invite your family and friends to hear over Easter, there is a blurb about David Mulready and his wife on the sheet inside the news sheet. So that's maybe helpful for you. And also there are invitation cards on various tables out in the foyer so that you can hand that to someone that you're planning on inviting. Well, we're binding off three chapters this morning. It's a lot. There's a lot in each of those. Maybe next time we'll split it up a bit, but three chapters for now. So let me pray before we begin. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have not left us in the dark, that you have given us your word. We thank you that you speak to us and that you long for us to listen, so that we can live the way as your creatures should live, to honour your name and for our benefit. And so, Father, speak to us now. Help us to listen and help us to obey. And we ask it for Jesus' sake. Amen. Well, The War of the Worlds is a science fiction novel by English author H.G. Wells, which was first serialised in 1897 in the UK and in the US, and then the hard copy version, book version, came out a couple of years later. It's one of the earliest stories that detail a conflict between mankind and an extraterrestrial race. It details southern England being invaded by Martians. The narrative opens by stating that as humans on Earth busied themselves with their own endeavours during the 1890s, aliens on Mars began plotting an invasion of Earth to replenish their limited resources. H.G. Wells in the novel writes, "Yet across the gulf of space, minds that are to our minds, as ours are to those of the beasts that perish, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against us." I'm not usually a science fiction fan, but I'm attracted to the book because an insane clergyman is important in the novel. But his attempts to relate the invasion to Armageddon seem to be an example of his mental derangement. He dies as a result of his evangelical outbursts and ravings attracting the attention of the Martians. Well, that is H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds. But we come this morning to another War of the Worlds. Not a fictional war, but a real one. A battle not between the human race and some opponent from another planet. A battle not even between good and evil, but a spiritual battle between the God of heaven and the God of this world. A battle between God and Satan himself, no less. Our world today is at war. You only have to turn on the TV or read a newspaper or go on the internet to find that out. An article in the UK Mirror, not that I want to endorse that paper necessarily, but late last year was entitled Wars of the World, the 22 conflicts around the globe that threaten to erupt. In Syria, more than 400,000 have been killed. There are more threats of nuclear bomb tests in North Korea. There are tariff wars about to erupt between the US and China, with Mr. Trump seemingly firing the first bullet. In Mexico, there are drug wars with cartels murdering people into the tens of thousands. And the Taliban continue to be active in Afghanistan. And the list goes on and on. These are the wars of our world. But behind these historical realities, there is another war taking place. And what these chapters 12 to 14 of Revelation reveal, is that the devil himself is the deepest source of evil. And for the people of God, the reason for their ongoing trials and tribulations is the rage of Satan. In chapter 12, verse 1, we are introduced to a sign in heaven, a pregnant woman who is about to give birth. Although some take this woman to be Mary, the mother of Jesus, it is better to see her as the people of God, both of the Old and the New Testament ages. And we then see another sign, a hideous dragon. And this dragon fights with a woman. It stands over the woman so that when she gives birth, it might devour her child. The child born, we are told, is a son who will rule the world with an iron rod. And this is a quotation from Psalm 2, verse 8. And there is no doubt that out of the people of God comes the one who is the Christ, the one who was born at Christmas time, who we remember who died at Easter and we celebrate next week. And instead of being devoured by the dragon, the child is caught up to heaven, which is a reference, yes, to the resurrection, but also the ascension as well. The woman, for her part, fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God to be nourished. The people of God fled into the wilderness. Now, the wilderness in the scriptures is a place where God protects his people, but it occurs in the midst of a hostile world. This is not removal from a hostile world, but protection in a hostile world. So, friends, here is a lesson to learn from this spiritual battle. We, as the people of God, are not removed from the battlefield, but we are given protection as we go out to battle. Deuteronomy 8, 15 and 16, in speaking of the Old Testament people of God, says, God led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery, can we say red, serpents. And in that wilderness he fed you manna, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you at the end. And we can think too of Jesus in the wilderness being tempted by the evil one, but also being looked after by God. And so, in the New Testament vernacular, we are to be in the world, but not of the world. And as we go about our business in the world, we will be attacked by the evil one, but protected by God. So don't be surprised when the grenades are thrown at you. But don't think that the grenades can be deadly. Well, verse 7 in our War of the Worlds tells us that war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against this hideous red dragon. The dragon fought back, but could not prevail, and so verse 9, the dragon was thrown out. And then we see here the identity of this dragon. He is the ancient serpent who was called the devil and Satan. And what we have here is a symbolic depiction of the defeat of Satan. And this battle and defeat of Satan in the heavenly realm is the outworking of the victory of the Christ in the earthly realm by his resurrection and ascension. And as we read this, your thoughts may well be going to Daniel 7 and the defeat of God's opponent there. And with the overthrow of Satan, John verse 10 hears a loud voice in heaven say, "The salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have now come, because the accuser of our brothers and sisters has been thrown down." Note, will you, the word "now" in verse 10. See, this is not referring to some future time event, but it is referencing the defeat of Satan at that very first Easter. Christ had full authority then, and he has full authority now. That was the time when the evil one was thrown down, and so the resurrection is the turning point of all history. It was the decisive moment when the power of the enemy in heaven was crushed and his kingdom came crashing down. And so it is a wonderful thing to celebrate, and we will do that next weekend. Praise be to God. And verse 11 of chapter 12 tells us of the means of victory for God's people. Firstly, by the blood of the Lamb. Secondly, by the word of their testimony. And thirdly, by implication, by faithful endurance. The victory comes, as chapter 5 verse 6 told us, because the conquering ram was actually the slain lamb whose blood purchased people from every tribe, language, people and nation for God. So friends, let us learn the lesson well that we've been learning week after week. Satan was defeated at the cross, and the victory of God's people is assured. And this verse assures us that the suffering of Christians is not a sign of Satan's victory, but of the Christian's victory over him. Well, how can this be? Because of their belief in the triumph of the cross, with which their suffering identifies them. You suffer as a believer and you are identified with the one who shed his blood for your salvation. And so the Bible knows nothing of a saint that doesn't suffer. But no matter how the world might appear and how bad a saint's suffering might become, Satan has been defeated. He has lost the battle over your soul. He might go his darndest to accuse you, he is the great accuser, or to attack you, even physically. But he is a loser, the biggest loser of all time. The means of victory, by the blood of the Lamb. Secondly, by the word of their testimony. And words are mighty, mighty things. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can always hurt me. And words can do great good. The movie, the recent movie, Darkest Hour, depicts the life of Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, in the lead-up to the evacuation of troops from Dunkirk during the early days of World War II. The actor who played Winston, whose name just escapes me, someone will tell me, that's it, Gary Oldman, he won the Oscar for Best Actor. It was a great depiction. And in this lead-up, there were many who wanted to surrender. The Germans had got them to the coast. There was no turning back. And it looked like a great, great defeat was going to happen. But Churchill turned the minds of the Parliament and ultimately the nation. And his speech has gone down as one of the most famous in the English language. It wasn't recorded at the time, but it was recorded 5 years later by Churchill himself giving the speech. You can go online and hear it. It says in part, "Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." And in the depiction of the speech in the movie Darkest Hour, immediately upon its conclusion, spontaneous applause breaks out. And as politicians banter at the end, one asks, what just happened? Answer, he just mobilised the whole English language. A powerful speech, up there with Martin Luther King's "I Had a Dream." Words indeed can be far more powerful than the sword. But the words we have, brothers and sisters, the words of the gospel, are far more powerful than any sword or anything Satan can throw at us. And so if you are feeling the weight of the battle at the moment, remember that we have the weapons, the blood of the Lamb, and the word of our testimony. We have the powerful words of the gospel, the message of forgiveness and hope because of the death of Jesus. And along with Paul, we can say, "I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to all them that believe." But as we proclaim that powerful word, we are called on to faithful endurance. Note that they did not love their lives to the point of death, verse 11. These believers were willing to give up all, to take their obedience to the level of even giving up their lives if need be. Would we be willing to do the same? Sometimes we reel when someone might dare to suggest we give up our money, or our time, or our talents in the service of the Lord. But here is the pattern for believers: being willing, to use the words of Jesus, to deny self, take up our cross, and follow him, even to the point of death. But as we do take up our cross, we're told in verse 12 of Satan's restrictions. Firstly, the realm in which he operates is restricted. It is now just this earth, not the heavenly realm. And secondly, the time in which he has to operate is limited. He knows that his time is short, and so he unleashes his fury because his days are numbered. And then from verse 13, it speaks to us of the persecution of the church on the one hand, but the protection of the church on the other. The dragon persecuted the woman, but she was given wings like an eagle to fly from the serpent's presence, where she was nourished for a time. The serpent retaliated, verse 15, by spewing water over the woman, but the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the river. Our minds again may be taken back to the Old Testament, but this time to the Exodus, where the seas were separated and God's people were protected. And with the woman's protection, the dragon was furious and went off to wage war against her offspring. God's people being attacked in every age. When we turn to chapter 13, we read of the satanic servants. In the nature of two beasts, we read of the first one in verses 1 to 10, the beast from the sea, and then from verses 11 to 18, we see the beast from the earth. The beast out of the sea draws once again from the book of Daniel. This beast drew its power from the dragon. The sea in the scriptures is a place of chaos and of opposition to God. Note in verse 3, interestingly, that one of the beast's heads appeared to be fatally wounded. But its fatal wound was healed. Now think about it, how can that be? If it was fatal, it couldn't be healed. And if it was healed, it wasn't fatal. But what we are being told is that there are many beasts who rise up. See, once one is defeated, sooner or later, another will rise on the world stage. So at the time, it might have been a reference to Nero. Later on, a reference to Hitler. Or later on again, to an Idi Amin. And on it goes. One's fatally wounded, but another one rises up in its place. But also with this, let us remember that there was someone else that we are told of who had a fatal wound and was restored. For this, friends, is none other than a counterfeit Christ. And this counterfeit Christ, verse 7, was permitted to wage war against the saints and to conquer them for a time. The response called for, verse 10, is patient endurance and faithfulness. Well, how can we do that? Because we know that God is still sovereign. He permits this beast to go about its activities, and just for a time. As we suffer, our natural response may be to ask God to spare us from testing. Yet it is often testing that proves the genuineness of our faith and results in God being glorified. As 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7 tells us, "The proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even when tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honour at the revelation of Jesus Christ." The beast from the earth we see in verse 16 makes everyone receive a mark on his right hand or his forehead. The number of the beast is a person and the number is 666. Don't people love that? They get stuck into that. What's this all about? One section of the Bible that movie makers and authors love to go to town on. What is this mark of the beast? Well, some outlandish suggestions have been that it is a microchip that at some point will be inserted in us. For others, back in the 70s, people seriously said that it's I think it was around then, when barcodes came in, that it's barcodes on our groceries and how evil they are. More realistic suggestions, some see it as the beast of that era, Nero Caesar. Others take it to be representative of incompleteness and imperfection. The number seven refers to completion throughout the book, and so the 666 contrasts with that. Others see that within that context, it is state-sanctioned religion that is opposed to the true Christ. And so we may see it and in leaders in places like Egypt or Nepal or Pakistan, places where certain rulers and certain laws want to destroy the church. Now, we might think that we're getting off relatively scot-free. We might think that the beast is in hibernation in our country. But I think you would agree that in recent times he is certainly being aroused, and we may well be blind to his actions and plans. However we read it, I think it is fairly clear that it refers not just to one evil person in history, but to anyone or any doctrine or rule that rises up against the Christ. And our task then is not to be trying to identify exactly who or what the beast is, but to be aware of the activity of the evil one and to resist him and his beastly servants. And so there are two mistakes that we can fall into. Firstly, we can be oblivious to the spiritual battle that is going on. Or secondly, we can be fixated on or fearful of demonic powers, not forgetting that Satan has been defeated and he's going down. Or he has gone down. And so remember that even the work of the devil occurs only on terms determined by God. So persevere, because you're on the winning side. But don't be naive, for he will still try to drag you down. Well, as we turn to chapter 14, John looks, and this time, instead of seeing beasts, he sees the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him the 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. Everyone in Revelation has a mark, either the mark of the beast, and you are spared the wrath of the beast, but must face God's fury, or the mark of the Lamb, and you are spared the wrath of the Lamb, but you will face the opposition of the beast. Rest assured, you will face the wrath of one or the other. The question is, would you rather face the wrath of Satan or the wrath of God? Well, Jesus gives a clear answer on that one in Matthew 10:28. Don't fear those who kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. Rather, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And friends, there is no more terrifying chapter in the Bible on that prospect than chapter 14 of Revelation. Follow with me from verse 9. And another, a third angel, followed them and spoke with a loud voice. If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, which is poured full strength into the cup of his anger. He will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the sight of the holy angels and in the sight of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment will go up forever and ever. There is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and its image, or anyone who receives the mark of its name. Notice, will you, that the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. There are those who want to speak about the prospect of annihilation instead of eternal punishment for those that don't know the Lamb. But this passage is very clear on the eternal longevity of God's punishment. And friends, while we may wish and our heart's desire be that hell not exist, or that at some point people be annihilated instead of enduring ongoing conscious suffering, we cannot and must not deny it, for ultimately it will lead to a denial of hell's existence. And if we do that, then for what did Jesus die? And friends, as unpalatable as it is, we need to remember too that there is no mention in the scriptures of anyone who finds themselves under God's eternal punishment, of repenting, of wanting to get out of that predicament at that time, leaving aside whether they can or not. They stay in their rebellion. And so, friends, as someone said, the only way to preach this is with tears. And to remember Jesus, that when he looked out over the godless people in Jerusalem, he wept. He wept. And so too might we, as we think of the godless society in which we live. And friends, if those verses humble us and at one level appall us, from verses 14 to 20, it doesn't get any better. For there we have a final graphic picture of the end time judgment. In the ancient world, large stone vats with holes punched in the bottom were filled with grapes. And servant girls jumped in and tramped down the grapes, squeezing out the juice that ran out through the holes and was gathered for use in winemaking. But here in verse 19, it is people who are thrown into this vat. For we read, "So the angel swung his sickle at the earth and gathered the grapes from the vineyard of the earth, and he threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. Then the press was trampled outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press up to the horses' bridles for about 290 kilometres. Once again, we must ask, whose wrath would we rather face? Satan's or Jesus's, who executes the judgment? And for all that we do in this life, and for all that we enjoy, is it our aim to see people rescued from this terrible, terrible future? And so may this horrific scene motivate us and spur us on in our task here at St. John's to love people so they may see Christ, to reach people so they may know Christ, to equip people so they may serve Christ, and to send people so they may proclaim Christ, so people can be acquitted at that terrible end time judgment and God's name be glorified. Amen.
Well, friends, we're going to stand and sing in a moment. This is our